Okay, so this morning we are kind of talking about some of the projects, and I'm Dr. Indran Lahiri, who is a senior lecturer at De Montfort University with a background research in digital media and society. And at the moment we are running quite a few projects, and one of them is the workshops with the older people, and we are trying to capture what the elderly generation thinks about and how they have been impacted during the lockdown and what is in there that we can do more about it. And of course in that project, Celebrate Our Similarities, we've got one of our directors with us, and Kamala Patni, who is the founder and the director of CAUSE, is with us today, joining us and talking through her experience of actually delivering the project on ground and how it feels like, and the kind of conversations that we had during the workshop. And so let's listen, and over to you, Kamala Patni.
Thank you, Dr. Lahiri. This has been a very interesting and exciting project area for us to get involved in. This is the first funded project that Celebrate Our Similarities has got involved in, and it's been a really good experience. And I believe what we achieved in those two workshops is quite different to the way most research sessions and workshops go, because we've actually connected with, as it turned out, older, mainly women, a few men, from the South Asian community, mainly the Gujarati community, within a day center kind of environment. So the people that came there were from who attend the East-West community center and the Saheli group. So they meet regularly, and we invited a group of them to join us, and it was an amazing experience. And I think this is an area of research that we've covered that may have been a gap that we've filled, I believe. So the idea was to, in view of what we've been through in the last couple of years, and the fact that Leicester has been significantly impacted by COVID, more so than any other city, because of the issues around the BME workforce, as well as the BME low labour market, and the vulnerability of the older population, the loneliness, and the all the issues around that. So this was an interesting area to try and talk to individuals about what their experiences were and how they've fared, and what, if any, gaps in provision that they think need to be looked into. So this was so the headline for me was that almost every one of them said that our voices have never been heard, and this is really good, and that moving forward, they want some well-being activities. I think that was the most persistent comment that I picked up.
Yeah, fantastic. So I think that, there were, being part of the workshop, I believe that I have captured quite a lot around the media and how the elderly population, of course, they are kind of looking to the media, particularly in a digital age. And it's very much around, it surely showed the digital divide that, of course, they were kind of talking about how it will make them more independent if they had access to, or if they knew how to operate on digital platforms. And some of them were like really happy to kind of stay connected during that time on and through Zoom, which was quite a good thing too. And of course they were kind of they were saying us that if we can actually deliver these kind of workshops in the future where we teach them about how to operate these platforms. But I think that the fundamental thing that was there was actually loneliness. So they were kind of trying to address the loneliness issue through digital device. And I think that is one of the strongest thing that came out of that workshop as well. So we are planning something going ahead. Of course, during the Manavutsav, we will be actually doing some of those workshops where we will be working on delivering sessions around inner peace, and we will be doing sessions around creative arts, and which will involve neurographic art and also digital platforms and how you can use those digital platforms to stay well, you know, when you are facing a crisis or something like that. And then there will also be workshops on digital device and how you use that. And I believe that it would be wonderful to actually have the East-West Center as a venue, you know, going forward to kind of run this one. And then we have got different sections of the community coming to then think about, you know. And one of the things that also came up yesterday was, like, it was a random thought, but, you know, particularly with a discussion on with Dr. Rob Watson from Dissented Media, and he was kind of talking about, of course, some of the work that he have done, but also if we can set up a radio station, and which is a wonderful, like, you know, I was kind of thinking that whether this is a kind of a joke thing that we are thinking of, like, you know,
I
talking
think
about.
I think it's a brilliant idea.
But it's a brilliant idea.
Absolutely.
And I think that when we run past that, you know, during our lunchtime, it was well accepted, wasn't it?
It was.
Yeah, and some people are really interested in doing that, which is kind of a thing that we would like to take forward, you know, and we'll have a conversation with Rob to see how we can
definitely
bring that to life.
Yeah, and the other point that I noticed on the way out was that I was being stopped here and there, being asked that will we come back to explain the paper that comes out and where it's gone and what happened. So they, you know, they are very keen that it's not just a tick box exercise, which is, you know, their experience in the past perhaps, but there is a genuine interest in making things better for that particular cohort of, you know, individuals, you know, age group or whatever you want to call it. I felt very enthused, and I was actually very proud, being from that community myself, as it happens, to be able to see that they were actually coming out of their shells. You know, there's some very emotional comments and very heartwarming points that were made, but also some very modern thoughts as well, relative to what traditionally within that culture people tend not to express. So it was, I think it's a start of something. I don't think we covered everything, and I don't think we sufficiently were in that space to be able to let them relax in such a way that you can actually develop some deep ideas. But yeah, it's a good start, excellent start, I thought.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the other areas that also came out, isn't it, through the conversation, is that there was sometimes, because of the lack of information, or maybe because of the lack of communication, or, you know, it might be that because they were not receiving anything which was translated or in Gujarati, that they found it really hard to kind of explore what's out there and all of that. So it, in a way, it also points me to the you know, to the discussion that we had during 2020-2021, that we need to be much more thinking about multilingual communication, and you know, which can empower people. One of the things that also came out was very much over-reliance on fake news, although they have not, you know, they didn't refer to as a fake news. But of course, from the discussion, we knew that there was a lot of anxiety within that population that then forced them to possibly unconsciously towards some of the news that was actually not scientifically proven. And that's one of the areas that I think that we need to build on as well, to kind of how people identify fake news. And there have been work now going on, and there have been some research as well, but there are things that you can actually do in a workshop kind of a situation to help people identify fake news and the content of fake news and all of that. So maybe that's something that we can also train people on in the future.
Ideally, when we do the digital training, I mean, one of the things that they mentioned, and this is an area that perhaps needs the funding as well, and, you know, these things don't come in sort of historically. These groups, and I know a lot of other groups, so it's not just this age range of groups, but in particular, the local BME population and the groups and organizations that support those that segment, the BME population, have expressed in the last few months, at least in the last 18 months, I would say, that too many initiatives are pilots. And they are pilots because the community has identified a need, a desperate need. It's only when it becomes a desperate need that somebody feels motivated to act on their behalf and connect with the agencies and the service providers. And the service providers do not have enough of a history with that group, that representative that is making a case for this particular project. So they feel that in order to test it out, they'll do the pilot. However, by the time the pilot, which takes a lot of energy to set up and a lot of free time, volunteer time put in order to get to that point, is then established. And then as soon as the project finishes, the agenda for the services has changed. So therefore they don't have the funding. And that's been happening regularly for years. And this, in a way, needs to be addressed as well. So this is a point that an 80-year-old mentioned. So, you know, it's not just a anecdotal information. This is real. What they were saying was that it's all, we do. In fact, it was quite interesting to listen to this particular lady who was talking about, I want to learn digital. I don't want to do knitting or anything. I've done all of that already. And I actually want to move on to what's going to help me now, especially because of what we experienced. That there's no point in you telling us that you're going to teach us digital unless you give us the right devices and actually give us those things. We don't even know what to buy. Apart from that, we need to fund these kind of ideas, and that's expensive. That is the issue. That is the issue about the gaps in provision, that for many, many decades, certain groups of people have lost out on the funding. And in order to meet that gap, it is going to cost. And it may look like it is disproportionate, but it isn't. And that's the message I would love to be able to express to the agencies, because the agencies are listening now. They are wanting to address, because they realize that without actually addressing some of the key issues that have come out through the leveling up idea, that you actually will have higher costs in addressing health issues, addressing social care issues and policing, and all of those public services will, you know, there'll be a detrimental impact on them if you don't address the root issues. And this is, in a way, the reason why the NHS is looking at social prescribing. You know, they're going to roll it out because they can see the financial benefit in that. And, you know, our communities that have been missing out must not lose out this time, because this is an opportunity of a lifetime to be able to make change happen that is actually addressing the disparity that's been ongoing for many decades, I would say. Sorry for going on, but I do think it's an important point.
I think so as well. I mean, in a way, like you hinted that, but I think in a way it's also connected to the work that you're doing with the Canals and Rivers Trust and, you know, the workshop that we are planning to kind of adapt a part of the DMUs and then, you know, working with other small organizations to then kind of develop art as a method for mental wellness, connect that to the waterways in Leicester. And some of the discussion over the last couple of days we had was around, you know, how it has been overlooked. And I think through these workshops, I think we have got a better chance of capturing what needs to be done. And that's what on the ground we are trying to do through these projects. And I think Canals and Rivers Trust is another organization who feel that they need to contribute more and work in tandem with the local organizations. So it would be wonderful to kind of scope that out as well in the future.
Absolutely. And in fact, we've got a meeting next week and we're going to talk about projects. I mean, I feel privileged actually for being recruited on their advisory board just recently. And I think that brings about a new voice on the board, and I think they recognise that as well. And well-being is their key priority, and Leicester is their key priority. And it's what was 10 years ago a government quango, which was the British Waterways Board, that is now a charitable organisation called the Canals and Rivers Trust. So yeah, I'm very excited about the possibilities here in Leicester for that. But yes, I mean, talking about the projects that we have got planned for July and the fact that we are adopting parts of the canal just here, actually, on the DMU, literally. So I'm very excited about that aspect because there's a particular area where we can make a huge impact through volunteers working on that patch. And also, of course, our sort of ambitions to bring people out on a boat and do reflective kind of journeys on there and storytelling. You know, we could be recording some of these stories there in time. And I'm hoping that in July we do the so from Celebrate Our Similarities point of view, we've got our good practice example, a benchmark that we are using that is having an impact around the world, which is called the Peace Education Programme. Now, if we deliver that on the boat, which we still have the logistics to work out, whether it's feasible or not, it would be fantastic because you go on the river, you have a reflective time, and then you learn about how we have our own internal resources and how we can tap into those. And, of course, the art side of it, we can have individuals coming out in the future. We can be doing art on the canals, by the canals. And there's some amazing things to actually, you know, capture. So I'm looking forward to all of this. There's a lot of opportunities.
Yeah, and I think centrally for the workshops and the work that we are doing, you know, it kind of goes back to like you were saying, that it's about storytelling, it's about people's lives, it's about their experiences, and it's very much about you know, I would say that it's autoethnography that we are doing, where basically we are inviting people to then talk about and where the next generation learns from it, but also this creates a record in time that people can look back on. And of course, there is also the thing of a change in the society. So we're looking for, you know, micro changes. We're not operating at a macro level because it's seen that macro level operations doesn't work much. But it's, you know, like you were saying, that's a ground up approach that we are looking at. And we are looking at how we can connect with people, with networks, develop concept on ground and work with people on ground. So part of it, I would say not part of it, but most of it is actually action research rather than research doing it inside closed doors. Mm. Because that I mean, I'm not saying that that's not useful research, but what I'm trying to say here is that research, when it kind of leads to taking some actions, making some change, that has got an impact, you know, whether that's an impact for, you know, academic institution or whether that's an impact as an individual, at an individual level, but it's still making a change happen. And it goes back and links to that theory of change that we are trying to address. Systems thinking is something as well, which you might have come across over the last few workshops as well.
Yes, and I have. All these phrases, systems change, and what was the other one?
Systems thinking.
Systems thinking.
Theory of change.
Theory of change, and just now you just mentioned, what was it, the audio?
Autoethnography.
Autoethnography.
Which is basically you laugh.
Can't even say it.
I know, it's kind of, I mean, isn't it really wonderful, like, if we break it down by saying that we are actually working with stories and learning from people, you know, it makes it much more easier rather than, and that's why I was saying that, you know, writing about autoethnography and actually doing autoethnography, it kind of positions you, so, like we were hearing some of the things yesterday in the workshop, and it automatically, it was connecting me with some of the things that I have experienced, you know, or might be you as well have experienced, you know, it opened up your conversation with one of the ladies there your mum.
That's,
you know,
right.
It automatically connects. So that's what happens, and that's how you learn.
And that actually, that's, thank you for reminding me of that, because that actually made me think. That's when the researchers, because I mean, I've never done research in a formal way. Yes, I've done it in housing. I used to work in housing for many years. What it made me think there was that just having that affinity with that individual, because she was my mom's age-ish, and she said something and she reacted in a way that my mom would. And it made me think that, you know, I drew out something that the others did agree with, but nobody actually consciously discusses it. Now, that a researcher that didn't have that background or didn't have that language connection with that lady and looking at her expressions would not have picked that up. So that's an area that, again, you know, something that we'd sadly actually discussed with Simon Cole, who so sadly passed away recently, and the previous police commissioner, was exactly this, that in Leicester, the services that have been developed since the 70s, something that we'll be covering in the Eye Museum kind of era, but that's for another day. But that the services that have been developed over the years have not the particular communities missed out, because they were very insular when they first came. So the Asian communities were very insular. So if they experienced any issues, they dealt with them within the community. They didn't go to the services. At that time, they were against, for example, taking public housing or taking benefits or anything. So, and tended to be business owners and that kind of thing. So the negative impact of that was that those communities didn't shape the services to accommodate cultural needs, and then there was a gap. But at the same time, or in parallel, the younger people and the younger generation were growing up in a modern society, and they were exposed to things that the older generations never experienced. So one of the things that's come out recently is the fact that there's, you know, young people's exposure to various things such as drugs and grooming and all of those things. And it is prevalent, maybe to a small degree, but it is prevalent, but it's something that's completely hidden. within the communities not discussed, such as well as things like mental health and domestic violence and that kind of thing. So those services haven't been developed according to the needs of that community because we didn't speak up at the time. But now the older generations are completely detached from being able to address issues that their younger people come to them with, or the young people just don't see that as an avenue for finding solutions with their parents or their grandparents or whatever, because they have no idea of the modern world, you know. And those are the people that we were talking to yesterday in these workshops. And I think that's, we need to change that, because even though you may say that the older generation will now phase out, obviously, naturally, but the younger, the middle generation, who are still in working age groups, still have gaps in provision. And the nature of our need for health is changing. So, for example, the NHS has just recently reported that in Leicester, there's an expected 37% increase in dementia and Alzheimer's anticipated within the next, I think it was 15 years, and this was about 3 years ago that I read it, 37% increase in the BME population of that. And that's huge. And the provision isn't there. The recognition within the family structure isn't there. So, you know, it is almost like what we are saying, there's a mental health pandemic coming as a result of the coronavirus pandemic through anxiety and all of the rest of it. There is also a pandemic potentially in lack of services having an impact within families and households who don't know how to deal with, and the services are not capable of housing all of these people. You know, care homes don't have culturally sensitive environments, because, you know, recently they're recognizing, and this is another area for the Eye Museum, sorry for going on there, but care homes are now recognizing that people with memory issues can be supported by finding materials and artifacts from when they were younger, and that helps those individuals to have a more fulfilled life in that environment. It doesn't address the health issue, but it helps them to function and helps them to be more at ease in their own bodies, as it were. Now, if we don't have those artifacts and you know, memorabilia collected for these communities, and we do create these homes, which don't exist at the moment, but if we did, then where will we get these artifacts from to get that ease? And that to me is similar to the social prescribing, where you can achieve a reduction, or the pressures on the public purse can be reduced by doing something as simple as collecting artifacts, collecting and preparing those kind of low-cost solutions, and they're social solutions as opposed to the medicinal solutions.
It's a great point that you have raised, and particularly, you know, I was doing a project in 2019 with the schools in Leicester around how migrant schooling has been reported in media. And one of the schools I remember were actually stressing a lot around cultural intelligence and how over the years, learning from the community, learning from the parents, because that school has got, that's really a multicultural school as well as a big one, a secondary school. And they say that learning from the experience is learning from what being said in the parents' meeting and stuff. They have made a lot of changes in how they do the curriculum, and they have brought in parents to actually do things with them. And as a result, that have also contributed towards the SATs and all those kind of exams. And what they were saying is that, you know, of course, they didn't have the practice of homework, but they have learned that, you know, giving the homework actually acts as a bonding for the family. And, you know, and that also gave them an understanding of how families work from a different cultural background. So literally what we're saying here is that that what you're saying, that culturally sensitive ways of engaging with the communities and learning from their experiences has got a lot of social value that we can create in a way. And that's what the iMuseum is for. And that's what the others are for as well, like, you know, the other projects that we are doing. Like you were saying about the memorabilia, if I can pronounce that right. So that one, I think through iMuseum, that's what we're trying to say, that, you know, somebody who has left their past in some other country and they're coming up and have resettled in a different country. Migration is a very complex issue, and it has got a lot of mental health, well-being angle attached to it, you know. So the projects, you know, that we are doing are interlinked, and that's why we think that it cannot work in isolation. It has to be connected. It's not that, you know, all of these have got different values. So when we're talking about iMuseum, we're trying to deep into the past of people, and we're trying to create things. And like you were saying, dementia, a very, very significant point that you mentioned there, actually came up with the course that I'm doing at the moment on mental health, because I'm doing a project on children. And I thought that, you know, without actually having a knowledge, I can't just go in and say I'm a researcher and I know everything, you know. So I'm doing that course. And what that actually hinted and to me is that between the age of 7 and 12, that's the age where people, like, you can forget things before that. You can forget things happening after that. But 7 to 12 is an age where in your subconscious mind, there are things that you carry forward. And whatever you do in life, you tend to go back to and reconnect with those, what you have heard or subconsciously remember. Wow. You tend to go back and connect with that, you know. So say, for example, something that you loved doing when you were 7 or when you were 10, you reconnect with that phase towards the, you know, when you're more going towards, say, for example, past 20, you tend to reconnect with those areas again. Or even if, you know, say, for example, because of the social connections you have, you fell into some of the darker areas, you still go back, pull yourself up and go back and reconnect with your past in that way. It's an interesting one of how brain works. So that was the thing. So that's why I was saying that, yes, it does actually help if you bring back something which that person has actually looked at or explored or was familiar with when they are in that stage where they need it. And in dementia studies, they are also studying parts of it as well. So in the Medical Research Center, you know, the center who have funded the workshop is something that also looks into dementia, looks into the things that you are talking about. So it's wonderful to know about the things, you know, and that's why I was saying that autoethnography helps quite a lot, because you have got your own life experience. And if a researcher positions themselves as a person, not as a researcher, in a research context, working with people, there is a lot of things that we can contribute to.
Ooh, don't get me started on that. I have some amazing ambitions, but oh gosh, there's a project in my mind that's been there for decades that I recently did speak to the director of the Mary Seacole Research Centre, and on the there was a webinar with the NHS and the social prescribing people, that in this city it would be great to do some research on like a preventative, not necessarily a preventative, but a pre-empting type of research where I know a group of people that can live in a shared house who are sufficiently knowing each other in advance and know that they have a capability of not falling out, put it this way, or being able to have that big decision made. Because the fact is that as we're getting older, we will get to the point where our kids won't be looking after us. That's one thing, a cultural difference that my mom didn't have to address in her life, because it was a given. You know, the older generations will live with their eldest son or their children or whatever. Now it's a given that we won't be living. And in fact, I wouldn't want to live. I would. But I wouldn't want to put that on them, on my kids, because of the way life is now. And in that context, I would like to then test out a way of actually having a shared house where people choose to live in that environment, make a decision to live in that environment where you have friendships built and a joint way of living that's very similar. So from my point of view, I like the idea of, you know, vegetarian food, you know, home cooked, and I'd love for a garden where you grow it. We live in a very friendly environment. We share our similarities in the way that we have our interests and whatever. What happens? So this preempting aspect that I'm talking about is to say that you have lived in that environment whilst you're younger, chosen to then maybe vacate your rented or your home ownership or whatever, and live in this environment whilst you're healthy. And then if you're talking about 37% increase in the needs and social care needs anyway, mobility and all of those issues will become prevalent as you get older, that knowing that you are within friends, a group of friends, company of friends, that you have a history with them, and the fact that you don't have to worry about having to move or being taken into a care home, all of that would have such a huge impact on the ability to maintain your health, I believe. And that's just a project that I would love to look at. On that point.
Yeah, and you can hear the bell ringing, so hopefully we have to make our way out. So thank you very much.
It's an emergency. Thank you.
Okay, so what else can I say? It's background and background noise, as you can hear, and it's like the emergency alarm up there. So, if you want to, we've got this these projects running, and we've got that website, so you can go to the COS website, and you can also go and find us on the Mary Sicole Research website. And if you want to get in touch then with the Celebrate Our Similarities, you can email celebrateoursimilarities@gmail.com, or you can also get in touch with me regarding any research or areas that you want to discuss at ilahiri@dmu.ac.uk. Thank you very much for listening to us.
And I'll just add that if you do want to get in touch with Celebrate Our Similarities, and if you want to volunteer to go on the canals and rivers, or you want to join some of the sessions that we're organizing for the Manavutsav during South Asian Heritage Month, you can contact me directly actually on 07855178841, or of course, as Indrani mentioned, celebrateoursimilarities@gmail.com. Thank you.